Ladies and gentlemen, we're beginning. Toda raba. Thank you very much. I want to thank the committee in alphabetical order, beginning with the Ness, to Jason Strauss, Yoni Teitz, and Rachel Waldman for their work and for allowing me to be part of the planning and preparations for this evening. And thank you who are here tonight, members of the audience, for coming out late night, late, a little late on Sunday night. I'm hopeful you'll be quite rewarded. I'm going to say a few things and I'll tick off the items I'm going to speak about. The first item that I'm going to speak about is a shift. A shift in this case meaning moving from one to another, from A to B. The sponsors of this program for the last 25 years, or the sponsor, was a family Lehman. And at first it was a Mr. Fritz Lehman, who was a member of the board of Mount Sinai for many years. And after he passed away, it was his children, his son actually, he had one son, Ron and Ron's wife, Devra Lehman. They, Ron and Devra, live in Ranana. But they still maintain a strong connection with Mount Sinai. Ron grew up in Mount Sinai. He's a lawyer in Israel. And they also sponsor, in addition to the Lehman Lecture, they sponsor Shalosh Shudas at the yard side of their mother and father. This Lehman Lecture series, as I said, started 25 years ago after the passing of Ron's mother, Ruth Lehman, a special lady. And after Fritz passed away, it became a tribute evening to both parents, to Ruth and Fritz Lehman. I was involved at the very beginning, and I was involved in the choice of the theme of these lectures, the interface of science and Judaism. Tonight represents a shift. There's a new sponsor carrying the same name, Lehman. I don't think you're related, actually. No, you're sure about that? You never know. But in any case, I mean, Mr. Ted and his wife, Ann Lehman, they are sponsoring tonight. And if they wish to, they can sponsor later ones, too. We'll decide that. But truth to tell, the fact that his name is Lehman sort of, you know, hit me and said, wouldn't it be interesting if we had another Lehman sponsoring this series? We call it the Lehman Lecture, but a new series, and the new series begins tonight. So the Lehman name was a factor, but it was not the most serious thing. The serious thing about his sponsorship of the evening is that he's dedicating to the memory of his parents, whom I knew, Max and Hannah Lehman. They were, we use the term venerable leaders, and it's on target. They were venerable leaders of Congregation Emes Vetzedek, which merged into Mount Sinai in 1986. After the rabbi of Mount Sinai, Dr. Coppell, passed away, Hannah and Max took responsibility to guide the synagogue. They did an exceptional job. I can bear witness to that. They just kept it going. It was wonderful, kept it alive. Their home was just dedicated to Emes Vetzedek. They engineered the merger into Mount Sinai, and Max passed away soon after that merger, unfortunately. But in any case, they were both special people. Hannah Lehman, his wife, actually taught Chani Hilutz was then the administrator, how to run the Beis Olam, how to run the cemeteries on the base of the maps. In any case, I cannot think, and I say this with all due consideration of what I'm saying, I cannot think of a more worthy couple to whom tribute should be paid than Ted's parents, Hannah and Max Lehman. He'll say something about them after I finish. Tonight's lecturer is Dr. Alan Kadish. I'm not introducing him. I'm going to say a few words, but I'm not introducing him. I'm actually going to say something about his father, whom I knew. And I'm going to take a few minutes to do it because I think Dr. Kadish is here tonight a little bit because there's a certain connection. I'm going to say just a word or two about it between his father and my family. And it's not wrong to say that the lecture could be L'shem Avicha, dedicated in part to your memory of your late father. In my home, we used to call him Shmulek. His second name must have been Samuel, Avram Shmuel. We knew him as Abe Kadish. Abe Kadish was the only person my father ever taught, in young person that my father ever taught in his life, before the Bar Mitzvah, and he continued a little bit afterwards. Abe and I were not close friends. He may have been a little bit older than I. We ran in different circles. But for many years, I and his father sat together in shul, most of the davening separately, but part of the davening we sat together in the back. And I don't want to say what we did. I have a lot of tshuva to do for that. But in any case, we sat together. We sort of knew each other. We weren't close friends, but... And we didn't maintain contact. But we re-met after many years in Columbia University Medical Center, the hospital, where I was chaplain for about 18 years. The first time, he was there babysitting for a grandchild. The second time that he came to the hospital, he came with his own problem. Abe was a special person. I'm going to tick off the reasons why I think he was special, and with that I'll conclude. It'll be a short statement. First of all, he was bright. How do I know this? Because my father said so, and my father knew bright. He knew that very well. He knew how to judge a person if he was bright. Er hot funem gehalten, that's Yiddish for saying that my father held of a, meaning he considered him to be bright. Also, even if it weren't my father, he went to Townsend Harris High School. Even I, the yeshiva boy in RJJ, knew that Townsend Harris was special. It was a super Stuyvesant High School at that time, and standards were a little bit higher, I think. He worked for the New York City public school system, Abe Kadish. He was a chairman of a math department. You don't know, if you haven't been in the teaching game, you don't know what that means, to have been a chairman of a math department in those years. It meant, first of all, that you had to know math. It meant also that you had to know how to teach. It meant also that you had to know how to teach teachers. And you had to know how to keep a group of bright people, math teachers, who are probably mostly Jewish, keep them happy and keep them in their place. And he did that. Above all, Abe was, and I knew this about him too, but his daughters-in-law confirmed this to me, was a person of great integrity. And that's why my father liked him and why he liked my father. He thought my father also was an ish emes. When I think of Abe Kadish, I think of the answer to the question that we raised in the David Mizmo. And that question is, Mi Yalev Ahar Hashem? Who has an entitlement to walk up to the mountain to escort the Aron Kodesh to its place in the Beis HaMikdash? And the answer isn't a long beard. The answer to that question is, Niki Chapayim Uva Levov Asher Lo Nosa Lashov Nafshi. Clean hands, a pure heart, and someone who speaks carefully. Now, I think that was Abe Kadish. That's my impression of him. One last thing. I am deeply committed to this Lehman lecture, the old series and the new series. And let me tell you why. I think that a shul like this, a modern Orthodox synagogue, has an obligation to have a lecture on science and Judaism. And it's not just because I read the Science Times on Tuesdays, or try to, or because Bishita, I consider myself a member of the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists, although I should pay dues, but I don't. I do this because I think we have to follow the Rambam in this regard. One has to face up to what the Aristotelians of the day, of your day, claim. And if there is a claim about something, and they had valid empirical and logical arguments to support it, we are duty-bound to face up to it and deal with it. I'll tell you why. Because our best and brightest, there are among them such who are troubled by such matters that are brought up by anti-religious people. And we are responsible to see to it that those best and brightest have a defense or have defenders, and that their people care for their welfare. There are those among the best and brightest who don't need our help. They like to daven in the shtiebel. Sometimes they affiliate with the shtiebel. Their faith is simplicity. You know, they live in compartmentalized lives. Now I'm a scientist, now I'm a Jew. But there are others who are different. And to them, we have to extend a helping hand. That's what I consider this kind of lecture to be. It's an inspiration along those lines. Above all, we have to help those people learn to help them make a distinction between what is science and what is pseudoscience. In my lifetime, I have seen the havoc that's wrought by so-called sciences. I have in mind two things that claim to be science. One of them was communism. It was scientific materialism. How many Jews were caught up in that and thought that that was the answer to everything? In one's own family. You must have heard in your family about how many. And always the best people. Always the best people. And also Freudianism. I remember one time, Freud ruled the wave, so to speak. I mean, people felt that that was the cat's meow. That was it. That was the new religion. And both of them, beide liegen in der Welt. Communism in its own way, and Freudianism is not even recognized by psychology, having whatever validity may have, whatever lessons it may have. But v'rabim chalolim hipila, that's a pasuk of Mishlei, which describes a certain mashal, but chachamim apply it to people who are caught up by strange currents. Rabim chalolim hipila, how many people fell victim to those movements. That's somewhat of the job that we have a commitment to do, to make sure that our young people and others know how to separate the chaff from the wheat. That's why I think it's important to help make, to see to it that we have a yearly lecture on the interface of science and Judaism. That's the reason for tonight, in my opinion. It's now my pleasure to introduce Ted Lehman.
Thank you, Rabbi Schneidman. I know nobody really wants to hear from me at this point. We have an esteemed speaker, and I personally would like to hear from him sooner than later. So I just want to tell you to add to what Rabbi Schneidman said. Congregation Emes Vatzedek, where I grew up, was kind of an unusual place. It was a very, very large synagogue. It occupied a whole city block of various buildings, and on the high holidays, the religious services were held in a movie that they owned. So I think the movie could hold over 2,000 people. So it was very, very large. And for some reason, the rabbi of the synagogue, who didn't have children, and my recollection of him as when I was very young, he really didn't have a lot to do with us, but he did take it upon himself to prepare all of us for our bar mitzvah, which was quite an undertaking, because this was there were a lot of kids, a lot of boys. He lived on Fort Washington Avenue, opposite what was then the Delafield Hospital, and we would start out in the afternoon playing in the courtyard, waiting our turn to get into the lobby of the building, and then you kind of worked your way into the his apartment itself. And for me, that was sort of special, because it was pointed out when I first started my bar mitzvah lessons that my parents had been married right in that apartment, right in his parlor, because he made himself available to, you know, Washington Heights in the 30s was just bursting at the seams with people from mainly a certain part of Germany around the Frankfurt area. It all seemed to be, the people in the Heights seemed to come from that area. And here was a rabbi that would conduct a wedding just for a few dollars, You could have it in his apartment. You didn't have to rent the hall. So there were a lot of people streaming in, and the same thing was true with bar mitzvahs. There wasn't a lot of concern about exactly how many years you had been affiliated with the shul. If it was a boy, they would have a bar mitzvah there. And the rabbi taught us, and I never really understood why, till some years later, I had returned to Emes Vatzedek, and I recited the Haftorah, and at the end of that, Rabbi Schneider made a comment about something about that he thought that was some reminiscent of Rabbi Koppel. And then I realized why he did that, because it kept his memory alive, at least another generation. There was another synagogue that merged with Mount Sinai, I knew Rabbi Kahn very well, because at one point in my life, post bar mitzvah, I went there, I studied with him. He had a very active organization for teenagers. That was the place to be in Washington Heights. You could be there Saturday night after Shabbos. Sunday morning, we would go there for breakfast club, daven, and after davening, there was always some breakfast to be had and planning an event. And he also, very different than Rabbi Koppel, he really was very, very concerned about us as young teenagers, that we would stay in the fold, so to speak, and find our way, different people. So anyway, I'm very pleased to be here and thank Rabbi Schneidman and look forward to hearing from Dr. Kadish.
Hi, just first of all, a few thank yous. Again, Rabbi Schneidman already mentioned that, but we really have to thank Yoni Teitz and Yael Klausner, the chairs of the Education Committee, for all the hard work they put into tonight. And we have to thank Rachel Waldman, our Vice President, who also put in a lot of work, and especially someone who Rabbi Schneidman didn't mention. We have to thank Rabbi Schneidman, who has put in tireless effort into organizing tonight's event, both in terms of the Lehman Lecture Series and also specifically in bringing in Dr. Kadish. And of course, if... What?
Kadish.
Yeah, that's what I said. Dr. Kadish. And again, to thank the Lehmans for sponsoring. Tonight's speaker is Dr. Alan Kadish. It's really an honor for us as a shul in Mount Sinai to hear from Dr. Kadish, a university president, an accomplished physician, and a much sought-after speaker. Dr. Kadish has been the president of Touro College since 2010. He was previously Touro's senior provost and chief operating officer, a cardiologist, a dedicated teacher and researcher, and experienced administrator. He's a graduate of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University. He received his postdoctoral training at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, an affiliate of Harvard Medical School, and at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, where he was a fellow in cardiology. He's board certified in internal medicine, cardiovascular disease, and cardiac electrophysiology. He taught at University of Michigan and Northwestern University. He also published over 250 peer-reviewed papers, received numerous grants, including from the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. He's a past chair of the Clinical Cardiology Program Committee of the American Heart Association and has been elected to prestigious scientific research and education societies, including the American Association of Professors, the American Society for Clinical Investigation, and the American Society of Physicians. His topic tonight, the Torah view of science, or what we advertise in Shana HaTeva, is often a code for the complex relationship between scientific development and accepted halachic norms. And it's one that many of us were already pondering this past Friday night when we had a talk by Rabbi Ari Clapper. And this topic touches on some of the most important tensions between modernity and Mesorah. So without further ado, Dr. Alan Kadish.
Thank you very much. Normally, when I'm introduced as a speaker, and people lavish me with undeserved praise, I tend to deny things. But in this case, since Rabbi Schneidman spoke about my father, I'll humbly accept the accolades because he deserved them, and also tell a brief story about Rabbi Schneidman's father that he may not know. He really had an outsized influence on our family because my grandfather came to the United States at a very young age before he was able to complete his Jewish education in Lithuania. So when it came time for my father to learn for his bar mitzvah and learn minhagim, they actually weren't family minhagim because those were lost. They all came from Rabbi Schneidman's father. So we have a few Litvak minhagim in our family, and they were all courtesy of Rabbi Schneidman the Elder. So you've had a tremendous influence on our family. And he spoke with great reverence about your father. So thank you. One of the characteristics of my father, which Rabbi Schneidman didn't mention, is that he liked dealing with tough problems, even if there's no simple, straightforward answer. And although this talk is not particularly in his memory, it's in the memory of the Lehmans, in his memory, I've picked a complicated topic to speak about only for about 35 minutes, so don't get too scared. But I'll tell you in advance, it's not one which can be wrapped up in a simple bow with a clear conclusion, because it deals with a tension, which I'll show you, has been around for a very long period of time. And the specific issue which I want to speak about is the issue where the Gemara or halachic authorities, as part of their halachic discussion, speak about a scientific topic and propose a scientific principle which affects halacha or affects the way we look at things. And that scientific principle appears to be different from what we think is true scientifically today. The concept which was mentioned in the introduction of Nishtana HaTeva is one approach to deal with that conflict between scientific facts presented by Chazal and what we think or what seems to be true today. So let me give you a couple of examples of where that principle of Nishtana HaTeva, or that the way to reconcile a difference between what we think is scientifically true and what we find in halacha or in chazal, I'll give you two quick examples. One is the Chumash, of course, speaks about the pre-flood period where people lived close to 1,000 years. And many Mefarshim are bothered by how could that be true. We know, first of all, that from the time of Moshe on, the Medrash tells us that no one lives past 120. And the clear explanation which is given for that is Nishtana HaTeva. People have changed. For whatever reason, Hashem decided that physiology would be different. And people, of course, no longer live to 900 plus years. A second example where Nishtana HaTeva is clearly used in halacha is a little-known halacha brought down in the Shulchan Aruch about how, after a bris, a baby should be washed in hot water on the day of the bris and 3 days later. And so the question is, what do you do if it's Shabbos? And the answer is, you can actually, in certain ways, if you aren't able to prepare warm water in advance, you can heat water on Shabbos, particularly to wash the baby in warm water on Shabbos, whether it's the day of his bris or 3 days later, because it was felt to be a danger to the baby if the baby were not washed in warm water. And the Mishnah Berurah is very clear. There's a very short Mishnah Berurah that follows the halacha and says very succinctly, Lo nahogu kein, we don't have the minhag to heat water on Shabbos to wash a baby who's had a bris in warm water. Dinishtana hatvayim, that nature has changed. So there seems to be, both in Medrash and in halacha, a strong basis for invoking the principle of Nishtana HaTeva to deal with the conflict between halacha as it appears in classical sources and what appears to be modern day science. But things are, of course, not so simple. When to apply that principle is a matter of some controversy. How to apply that principle is a matter of some controversy. Many halachic authorities don't accept it instead of except in unusual circumstances. And so I thought those two examples that I provided to start with, I'd go to the first reference, and of course we won't read all the references, which talks about an elegant but very straightforward question. Can you kill lice on Shabbos? So the Gemara in Shabbos brings down two opinions and appears to conclude with the majority opinion of the Rabbanan that you're allowed to kill lice on Shabbos because they don't procreate sexually, and the prohibition against killing animals on Shabbos comes from Elim that procreate sexually, and therefore if we have lice that don't procreate sexually, it's okay to kill them on Shabbos. So what's the problem with that construct? Right. How do we know? The eggs are all over the place for anyone who's been to lice check. So what do we do halachically? Are you allowed to kill lice on Shabbos or not? The halacha is very clear. You can kill lice on Shabbos. It's brought down in the Shulchan Aruch from the Gemara very clearly that you're allowed to kill lice on Shabbos. So I'm going to save that question till later, till we examine some of the issues behind this potential conflict between scientific principles as brought down in halacha and what we believe are scientific principles today. So I want to start by examining how the Torah views these scientific principles. And the earliest example that I was able to find is the question of what produces day and night. And I don't want you to get caught up in modern day astronomy right now. This is simply a theoretical discussion to analyze the sense to which we believe that scientific principles brought down by Chazal are inviolate. So this is a Gemara in Pesachim, which is in reference to, and it's an argument about what produces day and night. At the time, of course, there were two things that were well accepted scientifically throughout the world. One is a geocentric view of the universe, that is, the Earth was the center of the universe, and the other, of course, that the Earth was flat. Now, neither of those are completely specifically discussed in the Gemara, but it appears that those principles are implicit in the Gemara's discussion. And I'll get back to that in a moment. But what's the particular argument that's in the underlying portion of reference 2? Chachmei Yisrael Omrim Bayom Chama Mahaleches Lamata Min Arakia Uvalalam Lamala Min Arakia. There's a rakia which separates physically the earth from the sun, and very simply, during the day, the sun has rotated beneath the rakia and therefore lights the world. And at night, it goes above the rakia, which presumably is opaque, and therefore we have night. And that's what the Gemara says the Jewish scholars believed at the time. The Chachmei Umos HaOlam Omrim B'yom Chama Malechas Lamata Min HaRakia Uvalayla Lamata Min HaKarka. The non-Jewish scientists argued that during the day, that the rakia was essentially irrelevant, that during the day the sun shone down on the earth, and at night the sun circled beneath the earth, and therefore it was nighttime. The sun was no longer shining on the earth. Amar Rebbe, v'nirim divarehem midivareinu. Rebbe, the great Tana who codified the Mishnah, says that it seems that the non-Jewish scientists were correct. Simply looking at this, one would conclude, as in reference 4, Rav Avraham ben HaRambam concludes, that in scientific matters, one does not necessarily believe that Chazal was divinely inspired, and therefore they could be incorrect. And if you look at the last two paragraphs of reference 3, very eloquently, the Rambam's son says the following. Uve'emes nikra adon ze Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Rebbe was called Rabbeinu HaKadosh, the Holy Rabbi. Ki adam kishe yashlich me'al panav ha-sheker. When he throws away lies, v'yakayim ha-emes, and establishes the truth, v'yachri'enu lamito, and decides things with correctly, v'yachzor bo midaito kishe yisboyer lo ha-hefcha, Ein Sof Eki Kadosh Hu. The essence of holiness is the ability to recognize the truth and be willing to admit if you're incorrect. V'hinin Isbar Lanu, he continues, Ki Hachachamim Zal Einem Ma'ainim Hadeos V'lo Mabitim Osam El Mitzad Amitosam U'mitzad Rayosam Omnea Omer Oso Yiyeh Mishayiyeh. And Chazal were empiricists in this regard when they dealt with scientific knowledge. They observed what they could see. They learned science as they could learn it. And they were not divinely inspired in their discussion of science. However, the son of Rav Avraham ben Arambam's opinion was not universally accepted. In reference 4, there's a comp to Rabbeinu Tam. Brought down, at least in his name. He was, of course, one of the Baalei Tosfos, although this is not a quote directly from Tosfos, in which he says, despite the fact that the Gemara said that the non-Jewish scientists were correct, in fact, the reverse is true, and the Jewish scientists were correct. How do we interpret that explanation of Rabbeinu Tam? Does he mean it to be a universal precept that the Jewish scientist must always be correct? Or is he simply commenting the fact in this particular case he believed that in the particularist explanation of day and night that in this particular case he disagreed with the Gemara's conclusion based on advances in science of his time, which of course don't seem to be currently accepted. And for the past 900 years, people have been working on trying to figure out which analysis of Rabbeinu Tam's opinion in this regard is correct. The bottom line, what I think we can learn from this Gemara and the subsequent discussion is that the issue of Das Torah, so to speak, as it relates to scientific knowledge, that controversy about to what extent we rely on Chazal for scientific knowledge goes back a couple of millennia and hasn't been fully resolved to this day. And so when we look at some further examples, it'll be based on the idea that the question of whether Chazal's view of science always had to be correct is one that, at least based on classical sources, isn't easily resolved. Now, there are some exceptions where things are pretty clear. One exception is health advice. Going back to Rav Sadia Gaon, who, of course, lived about 250 years after the codification of the Talmud, he very clearly states at the bottom of reference 6 that one should not use medical advice in the Gemara to treat oneself or anyone else. And in fact, not only that, it's dangerous. In the second part of what's underlined at the bottom, Kimilvada Shalo Yoil, not only might these medical cures not help, Efsher Sh'od Yazik, there could be toxic side effects. V'lochein Ein L'shtamesh Bahen Rakish Yadu B'vadai She'en Bahem Sakana. Therefore, you shouldn't use them unless it's absolutely certain that there's no danger. There are a number of medicinal cures recommended in the Gemara that don't seem, again, based on our current knowledge or current experience, to have any validity. And as going back to Rav Sadia Gaon, it's recommended that in that particular case, we don't assume that the medical advice in the Gemara is anything that we ought to use. The Rambam in Mor Nevuchim in reference 7 very specifically says that about science and in other places about medicine. You must, however, not expect, and this is in English because, of course, it was written in Arabic, and translating a manuscript that was translated from Arabic into Hebrew, from Hebrew to English, doesn't seem to make much sense to me. You must, however, not expect that everything our sages say respecting astronomical manners should agree with observation, for mathematics were not fully developed in those days, and their statements were not based on the authority of the prophets, but on the knowledge which they themselves possessed or derived from contemporary men of science. And in other places, as I mentioned, he says the same thing about medical advances. So, with regard to medical advances, there seems to be a general acceptance of the fact that we shouldn't rely on medical advice preferred by Chazal. And according to the Rambam, not on scientific advice either. But in an absolutely brilliant and prescient analysis, the Maharam Sheikh questions our ability to overrule Chazal in matters of science based on modern-day observations. And he does it because he doesn't think science is infallible. And of course it's not. But what's amazing to me is that writing in about 1850, he was able to discern some of the problems with scientific analysis, which we've seen highlighted only in the past couple of decades. So I think it's worth reading a couple of those things. And basically, he has three or four objections to accepting medical opinions from current day practitioners in his time. And the issue the Maharam Sheikh was dealing with, which if we have time to, we'll get to at the end of the talk, is Metitza Bepeh. And at that time, there was an epidemic among some Jewish babies who underwent direct oral suction during circumcision. And the Maharam Sheikh firmly believed that Metitza Bepeh should continue. And he basically criticized the science of the day for a number of reasons in support of his halachic opinion. But what was so brilliant about what he wrote was he actually correctly identified a number of problems with science. His first problem, of course, is that many physicians weren't Jewish or weren't observant Jews, and he was skeptical about that, not because there was anything in general inferior about them, but because he felt that they could be susceptible to corruption. And what he said was, if you look at the second underlined piece of this, "Dimavakshim lahamtzi devar mechudashim, v'yashan mitnei chadash yotziu laharos chachmasam." What he's saying is that the physicians of his day were pressured to make new scientific advances, and sometimes, therefore, would fraudulently claim that something was true because they were under pressure to publish and would gain a greater reputation as physicians if they published new information. You all may be aware, taking one other example, of very recently, and there have been examples up to 2015, but one that's relevant to something that's going on today. In 2007, there was an extensive paper published in The Lancet, considered by some to be the second leading medical journal in the world, showing that childhood vaccination led to autism. And the anti-vaccination movement was in part triggered by that paper in The Lancet. It got picked up by talk show hosts, by Jenny McCarthy, spread to a lot of other places, including segments of the Jewish community. And there was only one problem, of course. The paper was fraudulent. The guy who wrote the paper was under pressure to publish because of a grant and made up the data. Autism is not caused by vaccines. And tens of thousands of children in the United States every year succumb to childhood diseases because people still believe fraudulently that autism is caused by childhood vaccination. And the Maharam Sheikh was concerned about that in 1850. Based on those concerns, and one other, the Maharam Sheikh was a Moel. And what he said was, the scientists of our day base their medical conclusions on anecdotal evidence. They've seen one of something, and so they say it happened. No statistical analysis, no scientific data analysis. And he said, I've been in Moyle for 20 years, I've never seen a baby get sick from a tsetse b'peh. So why is their observation any better than mine? And of course he was absolutely right. Medicine until recently was based on anecdotal data, and there were many false advances in medicine and in science because anecdotes didn't really define the truth. They were simply stories about one case. The medical way to sum that up is the plural of anecdotes is not data. Meaning if you see two cases of something, it doesn't mean something is real. Now, are the Maharam Sheikh's objections still valid today? Well, for one thing, there are a bunch of observant Jewish doctors and scientists. So that piece of his concern is probably gone. For a second, scientific publications are no longer based on anecdotes. They're based on data analysis, statistical analysis, and controlled trials. The problem of fraud is not gone. As I said, it continues in 2015. But the mechanisms to be protected against fraud have improved dramatically recently. So I would say his objections were completely accurate for 1850. They were a little less accurate for 2016. Nonetheless, it's important to remember, as we analyze the next couple of cases where it seems that modern-day scientific knowledge diverges from what appears in the Gemara or Halacha, that science is not infallible. We can be wrong. We often are wrong. And we will be wrong. So I want to now turn to two complicated cases where Nishtana HaTeva and the conflict between the science and the Gemara and modern-day science exists, and show you how in these two different cases, different conclusions are drawn, and then close by trying to suggest some principles to reflect those two different conclusions. So the first case begins in reference 10 and has to do with the viability of a preterm fetus. And the Gemara, both in the Bavli and Yerushalmi, states, which in fact was based on scientific knowledge of the time, that a fetus that's born after 7 months of gestation can survive. A fetus that's born after 9 months of gestation can survive. But a fetus that's born after 8 months of gestation will not survive. So what's the halachic implication that's clearly laid out in the Gemara in reference 11? That ben shiva mechalim alavas hashabbos, if a baby is born after 7 months of gestation, we desecrate the Shabbos to save his life. Uven shmona ein mechalim alavas hashabbos. But a baby that's born after 8 months of gestation, if you're required to do melacha on Shabbos, work on Shabbos, to save their lives, you don't do it. A striking observation based on scientific principle of the day. So, it's very clear that that's not true. We now well know that survival of a fetus increases asymptotically as the number of weeks of gestation increases. So what do we do? What do we do about a preterm fetus today? A Jewish physician's on call. Pretty obvious that the halacha must be that we intervene to save the life of that baby. But how do we reconcile the Gemara, which says very clearly that an eight-month baby is not viable, a fetus born after 8 months of gestation is not viable, with current scientific experience, which clearly shows it's not the case? I'm sorry? So, very good point. The answer is absolutely yes. You don't need an incubator for a baby born after 8 months. After six, five, seven, yes. Can an incubator, a baby after 8 months gestation survive without an incubator? Maybe not 100% of the time, but certainly often. But incubator is one of the arguments that is, as you suggest, advanced for the change in halacha. Any other ideas? What possible approaches could there be? Get healthier. Well, one is obvious, right? One we talked about already. one could say Nishana HaTeva. Nature has changed. Perhaps a little bit difficult to invoke in this case, but certainly no less believable than some of the other cases of Nishana HaTeva that we talked about earlier. Those and several others are used by Poskim to try to analyze this. And what I want to show you from halachic authorities in the next few references is that those explanations, as well as several others, are used to establish the halacha that, of course, we would intervene to save a fetus after 8 months of gestation. So going back to the Ritva, he says, Sharei ateva machishan legamrei v'gam amasim. There seems to be a contradiction between our experience, this is in the 1200s, that those babies can survive, and the Gemara, which says they can't. So here he invokes another principle that's utilized to try to resolve this contradiction, v'ulai lefi mekomam dibru, that things were different in Babylonia at that time. Not necessarily Nishana ateva, but that things were different. In reference 13, Tosfos uses another possible explanation, She'ein anu bikiyim, which is that we can't tell the exact age of gestation. He seems to be referring to our medical knowledge as of his generation, also in the 12th century. Doesn't seem to be referring to the Gemara, but basically says, even going back at that time, of course we would intervene to save a fetus after 8 months of gestation, because we're not sure about where things stand. Chazanish, writing about 700 years later, specifically invokes one of the issues we talked about, Vahari Nishtanu Advoya, nature changed. And while it clearly was true at the time of the Gemara that this was the case, it isn't true any longer. The idea that incubators have changed the situation is utilized by several contemporary halachic authorities, including Rav Vosner and Rav Neuwirth, both saying that at the time that incubators are present and better medical care is present, that all bets are off, and of course one should intervene to save a fetus regardless of the age of gestation. So what I've hoped to show you here is that there are a number of different ways to resolve the contradiction between scientific facts in the Gemara and what appears to be our current day experience, including as Chazal weren't experts in this area, that nature has changed, that there are different physical situations at different times and places, that scientific advances have changed things. But they're all based on the principle, in this particular case, that the halacha could be changed. Yes? So this was actually the medical knowledge of the time. And if you look back at what the Rambam wrote and Rav Avraham ben Rambam wrote, their belief was that in many cases Chazal utilized medical knowledge of their time to produce this halacha. How did it start? There's a theory that some physician's family was in kind of trouble and came up with this idea to justify some things that happened. But no one really knows. But that was the prevalent sort of Greek medical knowledge of the time. When a situation where pikuach nefesh is involved is, Chazal have been willing to invoke a variety of different explanations to overturn the halacha of not intervening on Shabbos to save a fetus who's 8 months old. But when one is dealing with a less serious case, that's when the controversy develops. So I want to return for a moment to Kenan. Can you kill lice on Shabbos? Obviously, not as significant an issue of whether you can kill a baby on Shabbos. And in this case, there's a machlokas that continues to the current day. And I'll just provide two people who have opposite opinions about this. Rav Dessler, writing in Michtav Me'eliyahu, says, and I'll read one little bit of it, Ein hadin mishtana, ap shelechora hatam ein muvan lanu. Sorry, it's not in there. The halacha does not change, even if the reason for the halacha isn't clear to us. Because the halacha was established for whatever reason. That Chazal knew you could kill lice on Shabbos. And the idea that they don't procreate sexually, that wasn't relevant to the halacha. Once the halacha has been established, the halacha stays, regardless of whether the reason has changed. And that, of course, has implications for a wide variety of halachic issues. In contrast, others believe that the reasons were important in establishing the halacha. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, in writing about this particular issue, said, when the Gemara said that lice don't procreate sexually, they didn't mean it literally. What they meant was that lice aren't really like animals. The eggs are microscopic, lice are small, we can't really consider them significant animals. And therefore the halacha of kinim doesn't relate to the halacha of animals. Other authorities, however, say, because we now know that kinim procreate sexually, one cannot kill them on Shabbos. And so that remains a controversy until current times. So I want to close by suggesting the following. If you look back at reference 9, Rav Avram Steinberg, who won the Israeli prize for this work, Encyclopedia Hilchatit Rifuit. Avram Steinberg is a very interesting guy. He's a pediatric neurologist at Shari Tzedek, an expert on medical halacha, and is also now the editor of Encyclopedia Talmudit. He's taken that job over. So he's as close to a polymath or Renaissance man as you'll find in today's society, attempted to categorize what's going on with this idea of contradiction between the science used in halacha and the science that we currently know. And his categorization basically encompasses all the different positions that we've talked about today. And he doesn't really come to a conclusion about a universal principle. But I've suggested to you that I think in this case, when it's not completely clear in any individual case whether to apply the principle of Nishtana HaTeva or not, it's not completely clear whether to apply the principle that Chazal could have been wrong, that what modern day poskim have done is taken a common sense, rational approach, which is that when it's very clear what the halacha must be, they've been willing to invoke Nishtana HaTeva to allow physicians to work on Shabbos to save fetuses who are born after 8 months of gestation, since we all know that those fetuses have a very high viability. Particularly, as mentioned, in the incubator age, it approaches 100%. In contrast, when dealing with something such as lice, they're willing to keep the halacha established as it was, even if the reasoning behind that halacha hasn't fully been established. Finally, based on a piece of the Maram Shik which we read, which we didn't read, the extent of certainty, since science is fallible and scientific knowledge is often overturned, as it was in many cases in my field, the extent to which we can be absolutely certain about something does play into the halachic analysis. If it's a case where we can see something obviously in front of our eyes, we generally accept it. If it's a case where there's some disagreement, then perhaps we don't. The Maharam Shik's principle And his view, for example, of Matitza Bepeh, which I mentioned this entire halakhic analysis was based on, would probably be identical today as it was in 1850. Because although there's a strong scientific consensus that Matitza Bepeh does, to a modest extent, but actually increase the risk of herpes infection that can be fatal in neonates, there are a few physicians who disagree and believe that the risk is artifactual and not real. And based on his reasoning, my own suspicion is that the Maharam Sheikh's view in 2016 would be the same as his view in 1850, a healthy skepticism about science, particularly when there's not a complete consensus. The bottom line is, I expect the tension between halacha and the science on which it's based and modern day science not to dissipate, but to increase as scientific knowledge advances. And it's up to us to try to do the best we can in managing often contradictory and difficult principles, to remain faithful to halacha, but keep our minds open to the fact that science advances, and the extent to which we can be sure about scientific knowledge increases as methodology improves, as science advances, and as we all learn more about what the world that Hashem created holds. Thank you. Yes. So the answer to your first question is that those of us who live in 2016 believe that the Mishnah Brura is inviolate and is the final arbiter of everything that ever existed in the world. But in prior generations, that wasn't necessarily the case. And it turns out that Rav Dessler disagreed. And, there were up till about 1960, people actually argued with the Mishnah Brura. And so did Rob Dessler. So the answer to your second question, I'll try to deal with diplomatically. But it won't be easy. This is the fundamental disagreement between the Rambam, his son, and other philosophers and halakhic authorities. And it's those views of the Rambam and his son that, in the Moreh Nevuchim, and in other places, that were responsible for the Rambam being put in Cheirim. There are those who believe that Chazal are experts in everything, including science. There are some sources which suggest that. There are others of us who believe that Chazal are the experts in Halacha, in Hashkafa, in Jewish philosophy, but that they're not scientists, just as the Rav Avram ben Arambam and the Rambam said quite explicitly. And that disagreement continues till 2016, as you well know. I'll tell you a story without mentioning the name of the person who told it to me, because I'm not sure he'd want to be quoted. He was sitting in a meeting with a bunch of different Orthodox Rabbanim from different members of the community, and they were discussing an issue, and they said, okay, we've had our discussion, we'll all go consult our Das Torah, and we'll come back next week, and we'll have an answer. And he said, I was a Talmid of the Rav, and the Rav told me that in Lithuania, he never heard the words Das Torah. He had no idea what they meant. Chachamim works, Chazal were experienced in Halacha and Hashkafa, but they weren't necessarily the final arbiter of science. And that's a conflict that remains till today. I'm not going to comment on who's right. I'm not going to comment on why, but that's the nature of the disagreement that underlies much of the tension in modern Jewish thought. Yes?
Obviously, there's a huge amount of knowledge. Is there
I'm sorry, could you speak a little louder there? There's a fan running here. Right. So, I don't think that there's a simplistic answer. From what little I know, I don't think there's a simplistic answer to that. I think you can see from the sources that it varied widely. Rebbe had no problem with saying the Chachmei Yisrael were wrong. Some others have issues with that. I think if I had to try to dichotomize, just as I did in the answer to the last question, what I would say is the following. There are those who clearly understand that their expertise is focused on halacha and Torah. And there are those who believe that years of learning Torah and immersing oneself with Torah provides a unique insight into the nature of the world. And that not divorced from science, because I don't want to suggest for a second that there are people going around who think they know all of medicine and suggest medical decisions without consultation. In fact, they have people whom they consult with who tell them a good deal about medicine. But they feel that a Talmud Chacham, who are some of the brightest of our people for sure, who've immersed themselves in a life of Torah, have unique insights, not to be scientists per se, but to understand how to incorporate scientific knowledge into advice about how to make decisions. And I can't tell you which one of those is right, or at least I won't tonight. Yes? So it's a great question, and I can't completely answer it any more than I have, but I'll try to take another stab at answering both parts of yours. I mean, first of all, you're absolutely right. We believe science is subjective, but as I mentioned, science changes, new scientific advances alter what we think about scientific principles. So I would say that the consensus is and ought to be that if we're going to think about overturning a halacha because of a scientific advance, that we ought to be pretty close to sure that scientific advance is established. Now, that doesn't mean we can't be wrong, but my own view is that we've been given the talent and the ability to understand the world, to understand science, and that we have to make the best decisions we can, but as I said, I think there ought to be a pretty high bar for changing halacha based on scientific advances. So a suspicion that something is true or one paper isn't enough. It has to be a strong consensus based on reproduced studies and almost universal acceptance that something is accurate. Why is there still some diversity? Why, when Avraham Steinberg tried to put this together in a set of general principles, what is he unable to? I think it's because poskim in general and philosophers have trouble with this issue. It's a difficult one, and we haven't reached a consensus, and we're unlikely to in the present-day halachic environment, of a universal principle to deal with it. The only principle I've been able to come up with is that when pikuach nefesh is involved, when it's clearly a case where lives will be saved, people are very willing to be flexible. In other cases, there's going to be a whole lot of controversy. And for better or worse, in today's world, there are not the few central halachic authorities that are widely accepted, that they were a generation ago, either in Eretz Yisrael or here. And so I think the chances that we're going to reach a uniform consensus of this are actually less than they were rather than more. I wish it were different. I'm not a rabbi or a posek. I'm only sort of trying to muse on where I think things are right now. It'll continue to create tension and continue to be a difficult issue to grapple with. All right, I think I've gone over my time by a bit. Thanks everyone for staying, and Rabbi Schneiman, thank you again, and thanks for your sponsorship. It's great.
I really want to thank Dr. Kadish for sharing those really important words with us. Thank you so much. I want to thank everyone for coming. I want to thank Yoni, Jason, and Yael for, and Rabbi Schneiderman, of course, for putting this together. Everyone is welcome to take some food. And if you have any ideas of people that you would like to bring in to our shul, people you would like to hear from, please tell Yoni or Yael. All right, thanks again.
Thank you.